This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Welcome to Keeping the Faith on WILL AM 580. Steve Shoemaker is away today, and this is Danny Otto filling in as host. Our guest today is Professor Jonathan Brown of Georgetown University, where he is Associate Professor of Islamic Studies and Muslim-Christian Understanding. He's also a member of the Council of Foreign Relations. Professor Brown completed his PhD at the University of Chicago in 2006, and he has studied and conducted research in Egypt, Syria, Turkey, Morocco, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Indonesia, India, and Iran. He has an impressive list of publications, several book-length works, a very short introduction to Muhammad, Hadith, Muhammad's Legacy in the Medieval and Modern World. He has a forthcoming book entitled Misquoting Muhammad. He has a very lengthy list of publications in scholarly journals and a long list of places where he has lectured and given media appearances. And some of you may have heard him when he was here on the University of Illinois campus in December, where he gave a lecture on the Prophet Muhammad and religious tolerance. What we would like to talk about today is Muslims in contemporary America or North America. Muslims have long had a presence here in North America, going back to the colonial period and throughout our history. In general, it would be safe to say that the profile of Muslims has been relatively low until the post-World War II period. And for a variety of reasons, through immigration and so on, we've had an increasing Muslim population in the U.S. And the population is quite dispersed, so that for many people, even in small towns throughout Middle America, their first encounter with a Muslim might have been as a local doctor or an engineer, as they were hired in these communities in professional positions. In the last decade, the role of Muslims has been much higher profiled. And in recent years, as they have, the population has gone up and mosques are forming in communities throughout America, they're more visible. And so this raises a whole host of questions. And we hope to examine some of these questions today, but I want to begin by welcoming to our program Professor Brown. Welcome to WILL.
Thanks for inviting me.
Professor Brown, this is a program that invites caller participation, and so it's not possible to tell where all our conversations might go today. But something that I think I would like to talk about to start with is the concept of Sharia or Islamic law. And the reason for this is that it's a term that we see a lot in the media. Many people will be aware that there's been several instances. Some states have passed legislation against Sharia. There are people who are concerned that there's a secret plan to impose Sharia on America. So I don't want to talk about the political issues, at least not right away, but I would like to talk about the notion of Sharia and how it fits into the basic self-definition of Muslims, that, as the name Islam implies, to submit or to obey God. How does the notion of Sharia fit into this Muslim self-definition?
Well, I mean, I think it's first it's important to stretch, I guess, our normal way of thinking about law, maybe even shift it. Usually, if you bring up, you know, the word law to an American, they'll assume that you're talking about something involved state, going to court, lawsuits, lawyers, things like that. The Muslim conception of law and the idea of the Sharia, which is sort of the theory or the ideal of God's law, is that this is really much more similar to Jewish law. The bulk of the sort of substance of Islamic law is actually nothing that would ever be in a courtroom. It's, you know, how do you pray? How do you perform your ablutions in order to pray? How do you do your prayers? How do you do your fasting? What sort of things break ritual purity? What are proper manners? Things like that. I mean, that's sort of the bulk of a book of Sharia law would be about that sort of things. How do you do your pilgrimage to Mecca? What are all the rules and things that are recommended or required? So a very small portion of the Sharia actually involves being in a court and, you know, suing someone else for a transaction that's gone bad, or someone being arrested for killing somebody. That's a small portion of the law. So that's, I think, a big difference between the way that the Sharia or the Islamic law is conceived for Muslims and the way that most Americans think about law. So, like I said, I think it's much more helpful for those people who know about sort of Jewish law and its history. It's much more similar to Islamic law.
I'm not expert on Islam, but I've read a bit and I know a bit. And, you know, in the Quran, there are some things that I've read that you made a reference to Jewish law, or what people would find in the book of Leviticus, for example, which gets quite specific on dietary principles. And maybe what we would refer to as family law, rules of marriage and divorce, sexual law, and these sorts of things. In the book of Leviticus, you know, we see those sort of compiled in great detail. But in the Quran, even though when I read certain surahs, you know, there are references to some of these things, but it doesn't have quite the appearance of a compilation as such. Where are these things compiled, and who decides what's in the compilation? You did refer to, you know, a book. Who would compile what is known as Sharia?
Well, I mean, I think it's the first thing to remember is that the Quran is not a very big book. I mean, it's, I don't know, maybe a third or a quarter of the size of the New Testament. I mean, it's not a very, you know, lots of Muslims around the world and in America memorize the whole Quran word for word. So it's not, it doesn't actually have even some of the basic practices laid out in detail. So, you know, everybody knows Muslims pray five times a day. That's not discussed in the Quran. The Quran never says pray five times a day. The Quran doesn't discuss a lot of things that people, including Muslims, would consider foundational to their belief and to their practice. The place that this comes from is actually from the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad. And these are recorded in collections of reports that the Prophet said, or descriptions of things he did. And these reports are called hadiths. And these are really kind of the source of the meat of and the bulk of Islamic law and practice, and even Islamic dogma. And Muslim scholars, kind of, you can imagine them basically as the equivalent of rabbis over the last 1,400 years since the beginning of Islam, have basically spent, you know, a lot of time reading and arguing and deducing and trying to fit all these different pieces of evidence together and figuring out exactly what the rules should be on, let's say, buying and selling a certain type of thing, or is a certain kind of food allowed or not allowed, or how do you, you know, how would you handle a prayer if you were, you know, on an airplane or something like that. So they would go back and look at these sources and try and figure out what answer they would yield when put together and read properly for any question of law or ethics.
So for a contemporary Muslim who necessarily confronts many issues that the Quran and the Hadith didn't anticipate, for them to understand their religious obligation in a certain circumstance involves what? How would they answer that question? You made a reference to your obligation to pray when you're on an airplane, and you know, that would get very, very complicated if you have a plane with many Muslims, because you can't prostrate yourself and go through the usual sorts of things. So who has the authority to answer a question if someone wants to know what to do if they're on a long flight that would conflict with several prayer times?
Well, the big question you're asking here is, you know, who are authorities in the Islamic tradition, and that's a kind of one of the great questions of Islamic intellectual history. The answer would be that a Muslim, a normal everyday Muslim, should ask a Muslim scholar. Then, of course, there's a question of who's a Muslim scholar and what qualifies someone to be a Muslim scholar, and Muslim scholars disagree about that. And that's why there's. You know, authority in the Islamic tradition is extremely decentralized, and you find a tremendous difference of opinion. There's consensus on certain core ideas and practices, but there's a huge difference of opinion about anything, like that issue of praying on an airplane. Some Muslim scholars would say, don't even worry about it. Some Muslim scholars would say, you know, try and face Mecca. Some Muslim scholars would say it doesn't matter if you're facing Mecca or not. There's all sorts of answers. Then the other question that's kind of implicit in what you asked is the what happens when you come across something that's not in the Quran or the Hadith specifically. And this is, again, something that Muslim scholars dealt with going back to the very early Islamic period when they, you know, the Muslims went out of Arabia and were confronted with all sorts of new lifestyles and geographical climes and habits and things like that. And they would base, one of the tactics was to use analogical reasoning. So, you know, the Hadiths prohibit alcohol, drinking alcohol. Well, if you come across another kind of intoxicant, like, you know, heroin or something like that, or hashish, then you would prohibit this too based on its analogy to the intoxicant of alcohol.
Is it fair to say that, you know, if someone says, a Muslim says, in regards to a specific issue, well, my religion requires X, or my faith requires me to do X, that what they're really making is a kind of personal statement, is my understanding of Islam as interpreted by the authority that I look to requires me to do this, rather than as a way of contrast, for example, the Roman Catholic Church has an actual codified set of canon law that one could say, well, canon law requires a Catholic to say not use contraception. Is that a fair sort of summary of what that means?
I mean, the difference is that you have to look at this kind of the distinction between issues that are agreed upon by Muslim scholars and issues that are disagreed upon. So, for example, no Muslim scholar is going to be able to say that it's permitted to drink alcohol. You know, no Muslim scholar is going to say that it's permitted to not pray. You know, no Muslim scholar is going to say that it's permitted to fornicate. No Muslim scholar is going to say that, you know, it's permitted to just say, to heck with the Ramadan fast, I'm not going to do it just because I don't feel like it. So there are certain things that, you know, all Muslim scholars and all Muslims agree upon, and those items, which are fairly numerous, you know, if a Muslim said, for example, my religion requires me to fast the month of Ramadan, they would be entirely correct in saying that. Now there's a lot of other issues that kind of go out more marginally from those core issues of agreement, and then that becomes subject to disagreement. So, for example, this is an interesting question, because the case of John Walker Lind, I don't know if people still remember who that is, the guy, the American who was captured in Afghanistan fighting with the Taliban right after 9/11. So he was recently actually had a court brought a suit against, I think, the Department of Correction or whatever the body was that was supervising his detention, and saying that he wanted to be able to pray with the other Muslims in his area of the prison, saying that it was required under his school of law in Islam to pray as a group if there are more than one Muslim. And the judge actually sided with him and said that, yes, according to his school of law, this is required. Now, for other schools of law, it's not required for Muslims to pray in a group. If there are, you know, not a bunch of Muslims in a room, they can pray individually or separately. But the school of law that he was following required it, and the judge kind of allowed his understanding to determine what was required for him. Now, if a Muslim said it's required for me to pray in a group all the time, they would be saying, yes, that's their personal or their school's understanding, because lots of other Muslims would say, no, that's not required.
This raises an interesting sort of church-state question that I want to pursue, but before I go there, let me give out the phone numbers and invite our listeners to call in and join the conversation. Our number is 217-333-9455. If you're calling long distance, you can call 800-222-9455, and we'll be happy to take your call and have you join in. So in certain circles, there's a lot of pushback against the notion that a judge should have any consideration at all of Sharia in a court of law. And this issue has come up in a variety of ways. But I think in Kansas, the state legislature actually passed a law forbidding the consideration of Sharia, which has since been struck down. But if I understand what you had to say about the John Walker Lind case, since our Constitution guarantees the free practice of religion, what he had to do was show that he belonged to some identifiable religious group that required him to pray in the company of co-religionists. And that it didn't represent all of Islam is not the question, as long as he could refer to some identifiable group that required that, that met the standards of the Constitution to give him the right to engage in that practice. Is that more or less correct?
The kind of the history of church, you know, the freedom of religion and the anti-establishment clause in the Constitution is, you know, of all the areas of civil liberties and constitutional law, you know, the big areas, you know, privacy, speech, it's the least well developed in the United States. And if you look at the Supreme Court's cases on this over the last couple of decades, I mean, it's very hard to figure out exactly what the rule is of how, you know, how our Constitution really understands freedom of religion and the freedom of practice, right? So this is, you know, if you look at things like freedom of speech, privacy, other things like that, that's much more robust body of a decision, kind of more systematic body of decisions. So I think in a way it's sort of still kind of Wild West in the way that courts handle these issues. It's very difficult because the Constitution prevents Congress, and it prevents, because of basically the states eventually also disestablishing religion, it prevents a state from passing a law that's going to restrict someone's practice of their religion. So, and it doesn't matter what that religion is, in a sense. I mean, and one of the arguments that was made in Tennessee for why, you know, the Sharia, Muslims shouldn't enjoy these practices because they said Islam is a cult, it's not actually a religion, which I think is fairly silly. If you have 1.5 billion followers, I think you qualify as an official religion. But I think that there's lots of, you know, angles at which this problem can be approached. One way in which courts have to deal with the Sharia is they have to deal with what are Muslims' rights in terms of their practice of religion. If a Muslim has to pray, you know, has to go to a Friday prayer, then, you know, is his employer required to give him or her the right to go and attend their, you know, leave work for an hour on Friday and attend prayer? This could be an issue that's disputed. If a Muslim woman says, I'm required to wear a headscarf, then does her employer have to give her that right, or can the employer be sued for firing her? Then you have issues of, you know, the United States courts actually dealing with operationalized Sharia law. What does that mean? So let's say you have a U.S. company that has a contract with a bank in Bahrain or a bank in Malaysia or a company in Malaysia, and part of that contract includes certain aspects of Islamic finance, or basically Sharia-compatible finance. The United States court is required to accept that as law when it's adjudicating this case, if it's adjudicating it here in the United States, as it would with any foreign law. So in this case, Sharia law isn't necessarily Sharia law per se. It's simply a foreign body of law that a United States court is obliged to deal with. And in fact, that was the big sort of what did in this anti-Sharia law movement in places like Oklahoma and Tennessee, was that they tried, in order to seem, you know, not racist or not simply Islamophobic, they said any foreign law can't be dealt with in American courts. And of course, all the business bureaus went bonkers over this because suddenly all their legal contracts with other countries were going to be in jeopardy. And an example of this in the United States, inside the United States, would be Muslim marriages. So, like, you know, Jewish marriages or Christian marriages, you know, Muslims have a religious marriage that they do, and then of course they also have to go to the you know, state court and get their marriage certificate like everyone else does. And what you see is a very interesting cooperation between states and mosques here, because let's say the state of Virginia, which I'm most familiar with, the imam, the Muslim kind of cleric, will not preside over an Islamic marriage unless you bring him the civil marriage document from the state court, from the court. He otherwise says, I'm not going to do it. Then, if that couple, let's say, God forbid, then wants to get divorced later on, and they go to the courthouse in Virginia, the judge will say, listen, I'm not even going to look at this until you two have gone to the local imam at the mosque and tried to have him kind of counsel you through these problems. So the court is trying to reduce its the load on its docket by having these guys go to basically get pastoral counseling before they actually come before the court. So you see here kind of the cooperation between the religious institutions in the country and the legal ones.
I'd like to explore family law just a bit further. One of the requirements for marriage in Islam is a contract, what we would think of as a prenuptial agreement that specifies a dowry payment to the bride, which is hers. As I understand it, you can correct me if I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that money can't be used for the means of subsistence for the family. It provides her some sort of security in case the marriage is dissolved later on. And then there are certain sorts of timetables prescribed in the case of divorce and possible remarriage and so on. So let's say a Muslim couple enters into the marriage contract, which they see as a religious act, but it actually is a paper. Is that a document that could be enforced by the state? So if someone violates it, is it understood to be a binding contract that's enforceable by our courts?
That's also a very interesting question. So you're right in bringing up the analogy of a prenuptial agreement. But in the Islamic tradition, that is the nuptial agreement. So the marriage is, in fact, the contract between the man and the woman. That is the religious marriage.
I see. So when you sign the contract, that is the marriage.
That is exactly
I see.
The marriage. It's similar to Jewish tradition. And the so this is a – basically, it kind of depends on how the Muslim couple was going to approach the court. If they went and said – so basically, what usually happens is that the husband gives the wife a bride gift, basically. And often, because we're not all millionaires, you give, let's say, a certain amount of money up front, let's just say $5,000, $10,000. And then there's what's called the delayed dowry. So if the husband divorces the wife with no cause, like she's, you know, hasn't cheated on him or hasn't, you know, spent all the family's money in Vegas or something like that. If there's no cause and he divorces her, then he owes her that deferred or delayed dowry. And that's usually significantly more than the upfront amount. So if, let's say, the husband gave $5,000 upfront, he might owe, you know, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 dowry. Now, is that document a contract that can be enforced by the United States or by the state that they're in? And that depends. If the couple or the husband, let's say, since it would probably be the wife in this case demanding that her contract be fulfilled, the husband could say to the court, well, you know, this is just a religious document. This doesn't really mean anything. This is just tradition. And try to make an argument that it's not really a legal agreement. The wife could then say, no, this actually is a legal agreement, and this is a contract between me and him, and we want it to be enforced. And this actually happened in the state of Florida. I think it must have been in the early 1990s. I can't remember exactly. But exactly what I just said happened. A husband did not want to pay his delayed dowry. The wife and her family took him to court. And it actually ended up going all the way up to the Florida Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court decided this was, in fact, a contract that could be enforced, and the guy had to pay up.
So this is an example, then, of a circumstance where what begins as a religious act, the impulse to do this as a religious act, it actually becomes a legal act that one could legitimately ask the courts to enforce simply because it was an agreement that was signed with witnesses.
If you were in Egypt or Pakistan or, you know, Bangladesh or Morocco or someplace like that, it would be a legal agreement. It would be that religious document would have the same legal weight as, you know, the piece of paper you walk away from when you leave the Illinois courthouse that means you're married. And that would then be the thing that you're held accountable to if an Illinois citizen wants to get divorced from his wife. So The I guess the thing that kind of gives it a dual identity is the fact that it's here in the United States, which has civil marriage, whereas in many Muslim countries or Muslim majority countries, the Sharia marriage is also the civil marriage document.
Well, I assume you're involved in and in more informed about these sorts of things than I am. You know, I'm aware of in some pockets of the U.S., a kind of deep anxiety and a lot of polemic against the notion of Sharia. What we've talked about so far seems quite inoffensive, and it's hard to see where anyone would object. You know, from your work, what are the issues that engage resistance? Why is it that places like Oklahoma or Tennessee and so on try to legislate against something like this? Because if they tried to legislate against Catholicism and marriage agreements based on Catholic practice or Jewish practice, you know, people would understand that that's ridiculous.
I mean, I think that there's a number of different motivations here. One of them is, I think it's really a kind of nativism and a prejudice against what's perceived as a new, unwelcome, problematic, dangerous, traitorous group that's coming to the United States. And in this sense, Muslims are being treated like, Catholics were before, or like Irish, or as Jews were. This, I think, is just another example of that same kind of tragic, unfortunate phenomenon in American history.
So it just happens that Muslims are the latest immigrant group that's
identifiable, and of course,
groups went through the same cycle.
Yeah, of course, things like, 9/11 and the numerous wars that the United States has been involved in and is still involved in Muslim countries, I think, lends magnifies that significantly. But another part is there's also a historic, in the United States, a kind of xenophobia against non-Christian notions of law and ethics. So if you looked at the United States in the 1840s, 1850s, there was in the 1860s, a very strong anti-polygamy, anti-Mormon theme in American public life, even in lawmaking. And the attempt to ban polygamy was one of the founding planks of the Republican Party, along with banning slavery. And it was seen as unchristian, it was seen as uncivilized, and it just had to be banned. It was a sort of foreign, unchristian, uncivilized legal idea that just was unacceptable. So I think there's similar idea that, that the Sharia prescribes or condones things that are seen as barbaric, and Americans are not comfortable with that, at least the Americans who don't like Sharia. And then there's the third maybe strand here, and I think this is tied very closely to that first one of nativism and xenophobia, which is that if you look at the way that anti-Semitism in Europe, in Central and Northern and Western Europe, developed in the late 1800s, and the way it expressed itself in the early 20th century in America, it wasn't that people weren't afraid that Jews were trying to convert other people to Judaism. They weren't afraid that the Jewish religion was going to spread. There was always this idea that the Jews were spreading their vile system. They were trying to sneak their evil system into our world. They're trying to corrupt our world by changing the system in which we live into their system. It's very similar language to the way that people speak about, anti-Sharia groups in America or Islamophobic groups in America talk about the Sharia, where they're not, they're not worried that everybody's going to become Muslim. What they're worried about is that somehow Muslims are insinuating their evil law and their evil system into America, and that without knowing it, Americans are suddenly going to wake up one day and the country's going to be ruled by Sharia law. Now, this is such a ridiculous idea that it's hard for me to really mentally engage with it, because I can't figure out, how that would happen. I don't really understand. Are they saying that, a group of masked, Muslim gunmen are going to go into Congress and hold Congress hostage and say, if you don't pass a constitutional amendment that makes Sharia the law of the land, we're going to kill you all. I mean, I'm not really sure how this would happen. And yet it's feared so deeply by those people who oppose Sharia in the United States that they clearly must have some idea of how it would happen. And that's, I think, that irrational fear of an evil outside Semitic system that's coming in is basically the new version of anti-Semitism as it existed in Europe in the late 19th century, in America in the early 20th century.
We're about midway through the program. The number, if you want to call and engage in the conversation, is 217-333-9455. If you're calling long distance, it's 1-800-222-9455. I will be back again next week as guest host. My guest will be Professor Michael Budd and the topic will be Issues in Contemporary Catholicism in North America. Professor Budd is Professor of Catholic Studies and Political Science and a Senior Research Professor at the Center for World Catholicism and Intercultural Theology at DePaul University in Chicago. And we will talk about, again, we'll see where the conversation leads, but I'm interested in getting started in talking about the variety of issues that have come up as Catholics engage broader American society in the political arena in the last election cycle, so that the Catholic bishops had resistance to initiatives from the Obama administration on health care and came out against it, and corresponding to that were a group of nuns that sort of generically were referred to as nuns on the bus who pushed back against the bishops. So we'll talk about issues of leadership in the Catholic Church, who speaks for the church, who has a say in formulating church positions and so on. And that will be on January 27th at 5 o'clock. Before I went to this little break, we're about halfway through the show, Professor Brown was talking about the sources of the resistance and the anxiety about imposition of Sharia. And I'm of the age where I can remember the election of President Kennedy, who was the first Catholic to be elected president. And I can recall that as a part of that, he had to go to the meeting of the Southern Baptist Convention in Texas and say that he would be president of the Americans and the Pope would not dictate his policy. So this certainly isn't the first time that we've had this sort of anxiety about the involvement of religion in American life. We have a caller on line two. Let's see if we can go to line two.
Are you there?
Hello.
Are you there?
Yes.
Okay. you brought up the Catholic Church. The American laws and what have you. How many, generally speaking, major branches of Islamic faith operate in the U.S. When we have many Islamic visitors, potentates, and what have you visiting? I certainly would expect that we'd attempt to enforce American almost law on living customs, and what is the effect of our of the ordinary hate groups between Islamic groups and the most famous American hate group that I can think of is the Ku Klux Klan. Are Islamics included along with Catholics, bastards, and colored as people that are to be hated?
Professor Brown, would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, to answer the first question, the first part of the question, I mean, I think that the United States pretty much has every single, sect or school of law represented here, of Muslims represented here. I mean, you have Sunnis. Shiites, you have Sunnis and Shiites from all over the different part of the world following their different local legal customs. You have different sects within those groups. You have sects that are kind of claim to be Muslim, but other Muslims don't think they're Muslim. So you have everything in the United States. although, you know, the Muslim population here is probably around 2.5, 3 million, it's very, very diverse. And the second question about whether, you know, what is the effect of hate groups on Muslims, sort of inter-Muslim dynamics? And that's an interesting question. I think that I've never heard the Ku Klux Klan attack Muslims, but that's just because I don't have, you know, the Ku Klux Klan podcast on my sort of normal rotation of things I listen to. For all I know, they're saying things, but I haven't heard about it or paid attention. But because, and also, I think that the groups that are anti-Muslim are very specifically anti-Muslim. I mean, they've sort of emerged, especially after 2000, after actually the election of election of President Obama in 2008. I mean, they really emerged and came in full force in 2010, around the time of the midterm elections, when everyone probably remembers the hullabaloo around the supposed Ground Zero mosque. I mean, that's when these groups really came out of the woodwork, and they're very specifically anti-Muslim groups. Now, their effect on inter-Muslim kind of politics or inter-Muslim relations is that there's kind of two major approaches that Muslims in the United States have to responding to these criticisms, and they're sort of at cross purposes. I'm not sure if they're entirely conclusive, but I don't think they're necessarily helpful to one another. One of them is to basically say, "Stop, you know, no, we're not different. We're not, you know, traitors. We're loyal Americans, and we're just like you. And look, we like baseball, and we like apple pie, and things like that. And we're just like you." And that approach, sometimes what it's saying is, "Yeah, we may wear headscarves, we may, you know, have different names, but we're still real Americans." And, you know, that approach, kind of the spectrum goes off towards those people who actually start abandoning practices, start adopting American dress, changing their name from Muhammad to Mo or something like that. That's sort of attempt to become native. And then the other approach is to say, you know, in the United States, people have the right to practice their religion, and we are Americans like every other group in this country, and we want the right to practice our religion, and we want the right to have our own values, and we recognize the obligation that we have as citizens. We recognize the obligations we have to our fellow citizens, to the defense of this country, and to promoting American values. But we're not going to change and sort of strip away our religion simply to convince other people that we're not a threat. So those are the two kind of approaches. I mean, one is sort of more mollifying, and one is more based in the language of the Constitution and of civil liberties. So those are the two approaches, and you can see how they diverge a bit, and that the people following the second might not be happy with what the people following the first are doing.
So when we have so many different groups, and at least the Muslims who are here as immigrants come from very, very diverse cultures. So I think one of the misperceptions many Americans have is that as Islam is primarily an Arabic religion, when in fact I think I'm correct that the largest Muslim population is in Indonesia.
Yeah, Indonesia.
Which is in South Asia. So when we look at the diverse geographic regions that people come from, and they're practicing their religion that I suspect for them is so embedded in their local culture that they might have a hard time sorting out which of their deeply ingrained practices are culture and which are religion. What happens when they come here and, due to the scarcity of mosques, are put into a worship situation with a very eclectic multinational population? How do they start sorting out what the obligations are and what means Sharia and these sorts of things when they arrive here?
Well, I think that what first happens is that you kind of have an initial sifting of the kind of religious wheat from the chaff, if you will. I mean, there are certain people who come here, and they're maybe nominally Muslim, but religion just not that important to them, and basically they then fall off the radar screen of talking about Muslims in America, because they may be Muslim, but they never go to the mosque. There's no way to ever kind of they never come onto the grid of people you're dealing with who are identifying as Muslims. Of those people who say, you know, our religion's important to us and we're going to continue to practice it, sometimes what you find is that people who in their maybe back home were not so religious, they come here and they, because of, you know, they're suddenly faced with something so different that they sort of, they actually have this increased identification with their religion. Now, what happens is you have kind of a dual trend that I think happens at the same time. In the one sense, groups tend to collect along basically ethnic, national, linguistic lines. So what you have in America is mosques that are South Asian, Bengali mosques, you have West, you know, have Albanian mosques, you have Turkish mosques, you have Arab mosques. There tends to be mosques tend to emerge around a certain language or certain kind of ethnic regional identity. But at the same time, those populations also are forced to look and decide what is actually our religion and what is our culture. So this especially happens in American universities where you have Muslim students, they all go to, they're suddenly in university and they go to the Muslim Students Association and they're face-to-face with Muslims from all around the world or from, at least from backgrounds that range from, you know, Albania to Indonesia, and they have to kind of decide what's the common ground of religion for them, and that then becomes this sort of new American Islam, which especially you see coming and learned and expressed in universities, and then the students grow up and kind of preserve a lot of that as they go on as adults. So you see that trend as well.
So in your travels, I mean, do you know what happens when we have people who come here maybe primarily as students who ultimately return to their country of origin, but they've been here in the broader American melting pot and also the smaller Islamic melting pot? What impact are they having when they go back to their country of origin? Presumably, if they come here and get university degrees or graduate degrees, they end up being in some positions of influence and so on when they return home. Is there a kind of feedback loop going on where people come to North America or to Europe and are forced to sort of rethink what the religion means to them?
I mean, someone like President Morsi of Egypt, I think he's a good example of that. I mean, he studied in the United States.
Oh, I wasn't aware that he studied here.
He studied, I think, in California for his PhD. So there's two things that you tend to see with people who've spent time in the United States or Canada or Europe even. And one of them is they tend to be more open to kind of adapting or adopting Western methods, Western ideas. They're more open to, let's say, like organizational structures that they learned when they were in the West, you know, student organizations. I mean, there tends to be kind of a technology writ large, not just technology in terms of, you know, smartphones and, you know, internet and things like that, but also just the technology of how society functions. And they usually come back with a real appreciation for that kind of efficiency. I mean, I remember one scholar from Kuwait was saying, he was giving a big speech, a Muslim scholar, and he was saying that, you know, when he moved to the United States, he was able to set up his phone line and get his water turned on and electricity within a day, and, you know, in his own country, it's still never gotten it turned on after like 9 years or something like that. So, I mean, you can see that kind of thematic desire for efficiency maybe incorporated into their rhetoric and into their minds. The second thing is you often see a broader sense of a global Muslim community that is maybe rarer in their home country amongst people who haven't really left. So people who leave and they come to the United States and they spend a lot of time around Muslims from other parts of the world, they go back and they're aware that, you know, if you really want to talk about Islam and what it means, you have to be aware that there may be Muslims in other countries who don't agree with you on everything that you think is in your nation's best interest, and that, you know, you have to come to terms with that. Either you try to improve relations with those countries or try to pursue common interests, or you ignore them, but you at least have to acknowledge that they exist. And that's actually interesting just to, on the example of Egypt. What you see is a lot of the people who've broken with the kind of mainstream Muslim Brotherhood leadership in Egypt over the last year and a half have been people who spent time in the United States and Europe and who have been disappointed with some of the decisions that the organization made because they felt that they were kind of maybe a little bit too self-interested.
So are the people who rise to the top of the large national Muslim organizations here, is it the North American Council of Muslims or some title similar to that?
There's a couple of big organizations. ISNA, Islamic Society of North America, is probably the most well-known.
What sort of influence would they have outside of the English-speaking world? I mean, insofar as they represent a pretty large population, are there international gatherings of Muslims where contemporary issues are addressed? And are the North Americans welcome at those gatherings? Are they viewed with suspicion as being too modern?
There's not really that I know of. I mean, there's not really a formal global, you know, annual conference or something. There are actually a lot of big conferences in North America that are the main events for Muslims in North America. There's one, the annual ISNA, Islamic Society of North America conference, which is usually in D.C. or Chicago. And then there's one that's gotten actually really big in Toronto every year called Reviving the Islamic Spirit. That's a really big conference. And I think that, you know, but globally there's just not, you know, there might be meetings of scholars, there are informal, a lot of informal connections, a lot of informal meetings, but there's not, I can't think of any big, you know, world, like something like you'd have like a conference of world churches or Baptist World Forum or something like that. I can't think of an example like that, at least not regularly. There have been in the past examples, but they're not, you know, there's not like a recurring series. There's an organization in Saudi Arabia called the Islamic World League that tries to do that, but it's sort of maybe not as successful as it people had hoped, or some people had hoped. You have the Organization of Islamic Conference, which is a UN-affiliated organization for basically Muslim states. But on the level of religious organizations or of kind of religious scholarship, I'm not sure if there's that kind of organization. In general, North American Muslims are not, I don't think they actually are more liberal than anybody else, I suspect. I mean, I think that, you know, Muslims in the United States are very diverse. You have people who are very liberal. You have people who are very conservative. And I don't think that, as a whole, they're more liberal than Muslims in Egypt or Muslims in Turkey. I think that they're, you have such a wide spectrum, or broad spectrum here in the United States, that I think that you have, an example of everything.
How about the role of women, and women in leadership in particular? I mean, not so long ago, in Christian and Jewish congregations, men and women were segregated. And in my childhood on Sunday morning, you know, women sat on one side, men on the other. And, you know, I drive by an old country church that actually had separate doors for men and women to enter. They didn't even enter the church building in the same door.
Yeah.
And now, you know, we've learned, at least those denominations that allow women to lead in worship and preach and so on, have learned that, you know, they can do this quite well, and life goes on and people receive, you know, the spiritual nourishment or whatever they came there to receive. It's not universal across Christian or Jewish groups that women lead out, but, a substantial number of them they are, and they're doing it with great success. What does the future hold for women in Islam in North America, specifically
as it has to do with
leadership issues?
The former head, her term ended recently, the former head of Islamic Society in North America was a woman, a Canadian woman, and she's a professor in the United States. We've had a woman leader of ISNA. I think that this issue is, you know, you have to back up and look at what's behind the question. I mean, Muslims tend to be one of the big kind of sources of tension in, you know, Islam-West, if you want to call it the Islam-West relations, is why Muslims are being asked to change. Okay, so if the idea is, well, it's only right and sensible that gatherings should not be segregated, and if you want to have segregation, then you're backward or silly or you're oppressive or something like that, and therefore you should change. That line of thinking is very problematic for Muslims. They don't want to be told, their religious practices are determined by their religion, and they're not going to change those practices just because someone's coming and telling them that, we've desegregated, so you should do it too. Especially, Muslims in America look around at the kind of problems, the way women are portrayed in media, the way, sexual interaction amongst high school students and intermediate school students and things like that. And this is not exactly appealing to them. I don't think it's appealing to a lot of people. And so they wonder, what is the path that we're being led down in the name of progress? So I think there are a lot of Muslims in the United States and in actually all over the Muslim world who call for increased female leadership. But they would probably not, with the exception of a few in the United States, they would not call for desegregated worship, or men and women sitting together, because they see men and women being divided in a place like a mosque is actually a very sensible idea, because if you see how Muslims pray, they basically bend over and stick their rear ends up in the air, and women might not feel comfortable doing that in front of men. Men might not feel comfortable doing that behind women. And in general, when men and women sit together, oftentimes the argument of Muslims would be that they're not always focused on what they should be focused on. So you can avoid all that by having, half the mosque be for men and half the mosque be for women. So that's obviously there's a lot of cultural traditions of segregation. There's a cultural traditions of female subordination. And that's one of the things that Muslims in America are struggling with. But the idea that they should desegregate and just have completely sort of blended worship like everybody else, I think strikes Muslims in this country as not the best idea, both practically and also a question of what's the path they're being led down in the name of progress.
I guess my question is more coming from the groups that have desegregated, the religious groups. It seems like, and the energy for that came largely from women, is they've learned that the patriarchal structures that were there in many of the religious traditions weren't there sort of self-consciously and intentional, rather than the origins of these religions are in patriarchal cultures, and so it's not surprising when the texts and so on reflect that. And
there's an element in which
one of the things that having a woman standing in, robes and preaching is to be exactly the antidote to the Hollywood image, because they're standing in front of you fully clothed, giving you a sober-minded instruction in religious ethics or spirituality or so on. So,
right, but, there's a difference between, there's two debates here. One is whether or not women can be in positions of leadership, and the other one is whether you want, in the congregation of a mosque, whether you want men and women mixed in that congregation, or do you want, while they're sitting and listening to a Friday prayer or while they're performing their daily prayers, you want them to have a divider down the middle of the room that's separating men from women. And those are two totally different issues. On the first issue of women in positions of authority, like I said, this is something that Muslims in America, it has actually been a huge issue. And the fact that the former head of the Islamic Society of North America was a woman, I think, suggests that there's changing ideas here and much more increasing acceptance of women in positions of religious authority. But you could agree with all of that and still say that you don't want the genders mixing completely in a mosque congregation, because worship would be hindered.
Yeah. The distinction you make is certainly one that, is easy to understand. I have friends who spent several years in Iran, and, I'm going by memory, but it seems like they're saying that of their theological schools, training people for religious instruction, not necessarily to be imams, but religious instruction, that around 50% of the students are women, mm-hmm. and that they would be then teaching in the primary and secondary schools and doing religious instruction. Are women seen as rising in the ranks of those who are competent to do religious jurisprudence and so on? And I'm asking you this question. I should also say we're down in our last 2 minutes, so I'm going to have to ask you to be fairly brief. But are women scholars in interpreting Sharia and Islamic jurisprudence, are they gaining acceptance in that arena?
I'd certainly say that globally in the Muslim world, yes. I mean, you're starting from a very low, bar. Their starting point is extremely small participation, at least in public. So, but in the last, let's say, 100 years, there's been, I don't even know what the percentage would be, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000% increase in female, open, public female participation in religious discourse, both as scholars, as preachers, as leaders. So there's been, but again, that comes from a previous position where, I mean, in the pre-modern Islamic world, I mean, women's role, public role, as religious scholars was extremely minimal, extremely minimal.
So that would suggest that change is in the air, and in 25 or 50 years we'll be able to see.
I mean, change is in the air because, I mean, that there's no reason for that. I mean, there's no real reason, even from an Islamic perspective, why a woman shouldn't be writing a book about, you know, the proper way to understand, you know, interest rates or some or a proper way to understand ethics. I mean, there's no conceivable Islamic objection to that. So why not?
I want to thank you for joining us today. Our guest has been Professor Jonathan Brown of Georgetown University. We've been talking about contemporary Islam in North America. We want to thank you, for all of you who listened. I'll be back next week with Professor Michael Budd looking at issues in contemporary Catholicism. This is WILL AM 580, Keeping the Faith.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Historian Michael Beschloss says Barack Obama broke with the past by making healthcare a priority in his first term.
Most presidents defer their most controversial programs until their second term. Obama did the opposite.
I'm Renee Montagne, a history of second terms on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings at 5 on AM 580 and at 6 on FM 90.9.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.